This is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Allison Stewart.
There's been a lot of talk about narrative in Africa.
Poverty.
Corruption.
HIV, malaria.
Focusing just on the negative stuff.
It's important because misreading is really the chance for complication and opportunity.
What we really need are African solutions that are appropriate for Africa.
If no one else will tell our stories, let's do it.
Africans have to do it in conjunction with everyone else.
On today's program, we take you to Uganda, Ghana, and Tanzania, the latter the home to the Serengeti, Kilimanjaro, and host to the 2007 TED Global Conference, which was titled Africa, the Next Chapter, which begs the question, what were the previous chapters? Well, if you believe everything you read or ingest from the mainstream media, Africa is a continent crippled by corruption and in desperate need of help. At the conference and at subsequent TED gatherings, TED speakers, mostly Africans from all different countries, have explored and explained why a new narrative about Africa must emerge. They believe there are great things to come in Africa in the 21st century. On today's show, we'll hear from a man who made millions at Microsoft and then returned home to Ghana to start a university, and from a Ugandan journalist who believes with deep conviction that aid is what really hurts Africa. But first, the director of that original TED conference in Tanzania is with me now. Emeka Okafor, welcome to the TED Radio Hour.
Thank you for having me.
The conference in Tanzania was titled Africa, the Next Chapter. What does that mean?
Well, our thinking at the time was that we had to unveil an Africa that wasn't that well known to a number of people, a number of audiences. And the way to go about doing this was more or less highlighting the work of individuals in a broad range of fields, from health to education, politics, arts, you name it, work that spoke to the fact that they were actually rolling their sleeves and getting it done, that they were not spending that much time talking about it. And even if they were, they were saying things that might be provocative, uncomfortable, but in many ways of a catalytic nature. The chapter that in a sense was emerging, existed, but wasn't broadly known.
Ori Okala described her father dying of AIDS, as well as dying as a result of inadequate health care.
The first time he got sick, he recovered. But what happened was that he had to be on medication that at that time cost $30 a pill. You know, so money ran out.
And it's very interesting how she uses the story to make her point, that if that was the only thing you knew about her, you might make certain assumptions.
Now imagine if this is all you knew about me. How would you look at me? With pity, you know? Sad. This is how you look at Africa. This is the damage it causes. You don't see the other side of me. You don't see the blogger. You don't see the Harvard-educated lawyer, the vibrant person. And I just wanted to personalize that because we talk about it in big terms and you wonder, you know, so what? But it's damaging. So what is to be done? First of all, Africans, we need to get better at telling our stories. Blogging is one way we're doing that. Afrigator, it's an aggregate of African blogs that's was developed in South Africa. So we need to start getting better. If no one else would tell our stories, let's do it. This is the Swahili Wikipedia. And Swahili is spoken by about 50 million people in East Africa. It only has 5 contributors. 4 of them are white males, non-native speakers. The other person is a Tanzanian first Swahili blogger. He's the only African who's contributing to this. People, please, we can't whine and complain the West is doing this. What are we doing? Where are the rest of the Swahili speakers? Why are we not generating our own content? You know, it's not enough to complain. We need to act.
Emeka, have you found that the African press and the alternative press have done the kind of work that Ori suggests?
Oh, yes. It's a very different landscape to what it was in 2007. The internet-based press, the blogs and stuff have flourished to the point where I sometimes feel maybe it's not even necessary for me to blog as much as it was in 2003. There's just been a profusion of locally and diaspora-generated content that is being put together by individuals who have an interest in Africa across the board, from recipes right through to political activism. And beyond that, we have more publications, even on radio. We also have many more platforms. I wouldn't say that we're completely there, but people do realize, generally speaking, that we need a vibrant number of voices speaking about a very, very broad range of things.
Another way people get information is through literature, which another TED speaker in 2009 approached the importance of literature and telling of stories. Chimamanda Adichie, she's an award-winning author. Tell our audience a little bit about her, and then we'll talk about her TED Talk a little bit.
Well, Chimamanda was born in a period after the ending of the Nigerian Civil War, and she paints a picture of contemporary post-independence Nigeria that many of us can recognize. And Nigeria, and this is not just particular to Nigeria, you would find this in a number of other African countries where you see this overlay of how adopted religions and a need to be like the West, but also sort of tying yourself to where you're from traditionally, created all these interesting conflicts. And she speaks to that, at least I think so, in her books. And I think one of the things that I find particularly striking about her work isn't just that she's become successful as a writer, but she also sees it as important to assist with the rebuilding of the literary communities on the ground within the continent, which is essential.
Let's listen to a little bit of her TED Talk, which was called The Danger of the Single Story.
The consequence of the single story is this: it robs people of dignity. It makes our recognition of our equal humanity difficult. It emphasizes how we are different rather than how we are similar. It is impossible to talk about the single story without talking about power. There is a word, an Igbo word, that I think about whenever I think about the power structures of the world, and it is nkali. It's a noun that loosely translates to be greater than another. Like our economic and political worlds, stories too are defined by the principle of nkali. How they are told, who tells them, when they are told, how many stories are told, are really dependent on power. Power is the ability not just to tell the story of another person, but to make it the definitive story of that person. I recently spoke at a university where a student told me that it was such a shame that Nigerian men were physical abusers like the father character in my novel. I told him that I had just read a novel called American Psycho. And that it was such a shame that young Americans were serial murderers.
Her point is so fabulous.
It speaks to the fact that if for a number of reasons you haven't been exposed to variety, mm-hmm. you come to define subsequent exposures to individuals from that space as being part of this unvariegated reality that you've had up until that point. You know, so I think we're talking about balance. We're not talking about sugarcoating. No one is saying that we should more or less highlight something over and above the next thing. But let's have this full panoply of stories across the board.
When you were assembling the groups of people who would speak at the TED conference in Tanzania, obviously you had to address economic issues. And one of the people who spoke was Eleni Gabre-Madin. She's an Ethiopian woman by birth who then went to work for the World Bank in Washington, D.C. She returned home as well. One of her big issues she talked about, I'm paraphrasing, I'm really boiling this down, was the way to empower farmers was with information about their crops and the price of crops so that they could compete effectively, I guess is the right way to put it. When you wanted to talk about economics, what did you want to make sure was addressed specifically with her?
A number of things. One is the distortion of markets, which occurs even in the best of nations, is something that is hugely disproportionate in Africa across the board. The fact that farming is seen as something that young Africans shouldn't do, because it's associated with poverty. The fact that when we look at this country, the United States, and we see what happened in the Midwest and the role places like Chicago played in evening out pricing and providing security mm-hmm. for farmers, none of this is existent across the continent. And her project, the Commodity Exchange, that is now live and working in Ethiopia, her speaking about it touched upon all these things.
Like its agriculture, Africa's markets are highly undercapitalized and inefficient. We know from our work around the continent that transaction costs of reaching the market and the risks of transacting in rural agriculture markets is extremely high. In fact, only 1/3 of agricultural output produced in Africa even reaches the market. Africa's markets are weak not only because of weak infrastructure in terms of roads and telecommunications, but also because of the virtual absence of necessary market institutions such as market information, grades and standards, and reliable ways to connect buyers and sellers. Well, I'm not here today to lament about the situation or wring my hands. I am here to tell you that change is in the air. After having spent more than a decade understanding, studying, and trying to convince policymakers and donors about what was wrong with Africa's agricultural markets, I decided it was time to do something about it. I currently lead in Ethiopia an exciting new initiative to establish the first Ethiopia Commodity Exchange, or ECX. Now, the Commodity Exchange itself, that concept is not new.
And so our audience knows, Eleni Gabrielle-Medin became the CEO of the Ethiopian Commodities Exchange. I want to make sure we said that.
And she was soldiering on and saying this was going to be done. It was another example of, well, it would be great to have commodity exchanges, but we haven't built one yet. Her story was, this is why we are building one. This is the impact it will have on the people in the most rural areas of our country. The fact that since she has gone along and built this institution, others across the continent have seen the importance of it. You know, the essence of showing how it's done by doing in many ways is exemplified by what she does in very concrete terms.
Emeka Okafor, we're going to have you back at the end of the program for some final thoughts. So thank you for sticking around. And as well, thank you so much for helping us open up the show. This is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Allison Stewart. On today's show, we're hearing some big ideas emerging from Africa, from TED speakers all across the continent.
Okay, are you there?
Yeah, you need a bit for level and so on.
We also reached out to someone whose voice is a familiar one to NPR listeners.
Greetings, I'm Ofebi Ekwesakun. At the moment, the Africa correspondent of NPR, based in Dakar, Senegal, but rarely here because I travel all over the continent.
Ofebi Ekwesakun, NPR News.
Kano.
Chinoy.
Luanda.
Bamako.
Juba.
Dakar.
Ofebia began reporting from Africa nearly 30 years ago. She is often the first person on the ground when news breaks. But she also seeks out the continent's more nuanced human stories.
The debate about whether it's only bad news from Africa or good news stories or whatever, yes, it's an important debate. But I think the most important thing is to tell a good tale. And that's what will make the listener sit up, prick up their ears and listen. I don't think it matters whether you're in Mogadishu or Missouri. They're going to want to listen.
Ofebia has covered conflicts in Zaire, Mali, the Ivory Coast.
Gbagbo's camp defies international calls for him to concede defeat, and he's sworn in at the...
But she's also known for finding unexpected moments along the way, like at a maternity ward in newly independent South Sudan.
This little boy you hear crying had only just been born, but the number one baby has already got his name.
Independent.
Independence was immediately nicknamed Indy on the ward. His mother, 24-year-old...
Being an African, I come from Ghana. I don't get stuck on how is Africa being reported. Yes, we can't get away from the fact that we report the conflicts and the poverty and so on. That is part of what happens in Africa. But I don't consider myself a war reporter. I want to report everything. And I think that is what I hold sacred, to make sure that I'm telling as many stories as possible. Like taking a barge. Well, I say a barge, but it was two bits of giant metal sort of clipped together and towed by a tugboat along the Congo River to see what life is like for ordinary Congolese who use this life source that runs through their country as their Highway 66.
The Congo River is tantalizing.
Somebody selling shoes.
Vous faites du bon business ici, and do you do good business here?
Je fais.
She says she makes a lot of money here in Mbandaka. And I think with that, she's dismissing me so that she can get on with business.
Merci.
Merci beaucoup.
For me, what's important is to make sure that the aspects of Africa, such as the culture, the music, the creativity, the innovation, the inventiveness and invention, all that gets reported alongside.
Distinguished guests, fellow students, ladies and gentlemen.
I heard about Ashesi College University actually quite a long time ago, but the story was proposed to me by somebody from NPR who said, look, we're doing a series about immigrants who lived in America and have returned home, done good, and brought progress to their country. So that's how I actually met Patrick Iwa.
The moment that students walked in the gates at Ashesi, you know, my emotions were wild.
Who used to work for Microsoft and then decided to take his family home to Ghana to set up what he wanted to be an Ivy League university in Ghana. But it was the students that really struck me.
You're like raw gold. The school is like a furnace. The heat from all the courses and everything, from the professors, from the project that you undertake, you come out as a refined substance. You come out glittering. You move with such quality.
The fact that these young people have such a belief in themselves and their continent and feel that they are the ones who are going to propel Africa forward. I mean, it was so uplifting.
That's NPR correspondent Ofebia Quist-Arkton. She covered Ashesi University's first graduation in 2006. A year later, Ashesi's founder, Patrick Ewa, spoke at TED.
The question of transformation in Africa really is a question of leadership. Africa can only be transformed by enlightened leaders. And it is my contention that the manner in which we educate our leaders is fundamental to progress on this continent.
Patrick Ewa says he is committed to educating young people in critical thinking and ethical service because he believes these values are essential for the nation building that lies ahead in Africa. We'll talk to Patrick in a few minutes. First, let's hear more of his
after
TED Talk.
This event, I leave Ghana on a scholarship to go to Swarthmore College for my education. It was a breath of fresh air. You know, the faculty there didn't want us to memorize information and repeat back to them as I was used to back in Ghana. They wanted us to think critically. They wanted us to be analytical. They wanted us to be concerned about social issues. In my economics classes, I got high marks on my understanding of basic economics. But I learned something more profound than that, which is that the leaders, the managers of Ghana's economy, were making breathtakingly bad decisions that had brought our economy to the brink of collapse. Leadership matters. It matters a great deal. But I didn't really fully understand what had happened to me at Swarthmore. I had an inkling, but I didn't fully realize it until I went out into the workplace and I went to work at Microsoft Corporation. And I was part of this team, this thinking learning team, whose job it was to design and implement new software that created value in the world. And it was brilliant to be part of this team. It was brilliant. And I realized just what had happened to me at Swarthmore, this transformation. The ability to confront problems, complex problems, and to design solutions to those problems, the ability to create is the most empowering thing that can happen to an individual. And I was part of that. Now, while I was at Microsoft, the annual revenues of that company grew larger than the GDP of the Republic of Ghana. And by the way, the gap has widened since I left. Now, I've already spoken about one of the reasons why this has occurred. I mean, it's the people there who are so hardworking, persistent, creative, empowered. But there were also some external factors: free markets, the rule of law, infrastructure. These things were provided by institutions run by the people that I call leaders. And those leaders did not emerge spontaneously. Somebody trained them to do the work that they do. Now, while I was at Microsoft, this funny thing happened. I became a parent, and for the first time, Africa mattered more to me than ever before.
Patrick Ewa, welcome to the TED Radio Hour.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Explain to our audience how parenthood played into your decision to return back to Ghana.
Well, all of a sudden, I was a parent of an African child. And more importantly, I was now a member of a generation that owed a responsibility to a future generation. And that's what the birth of my son did for me. It just made me realize that I owed a responsibility to an entire generation that was going to come after me and their children as well. And so that got me to really think more deeply about what was going on in Africa and what I ought to be doing to make the world a better place for this future generation.
With a professional background that isn't in an education, why did you think starting a liberal arts college would help improve things in Ghana?
The thing about the liberal arts is that it teaches people to think very broadly. It teaches people to see things from different perspectives. It teaches critical thinking and problem solving. And it gives students sort of a philosophical perspective about their role in society. There's just this strong teaching of about ethics and responsibility that I felt are extremely important, regardless of, you know, the technical skill that somebody is acquiring in college. And I felt that this was missing in education in Africa. And I felt that this was the root of a lot of the problems that we have in terms of the leadership crisis that we have on the continent.
I asked the question, well, what is it about Ghana that produces leaders that are unethical or unable to solve problems? So I went to look at what was happening in our educational system, and it's the same. Learning by rote from primary school through graduate school. Very little emphasis on ethics. And the average, you know, the typical graduate from a university in Ghana has a stronger sense of entitlement than a sense of responsibility. This is wrong. So I decided to engage this particular problem because it seems to me that every society must be very intentional about how it trains its leaders. And Ghana was not paying enough attention, and this is true across sub-Saharan Africa, actually. So this is what I'm doing. I'm trying to bring the experience that I had at Swarthmore to Africa. I wish there was a liberal arts college in every African country. I think it would make a huge difference. And what Ashesi University is trying to do is to train a new generation of ethical, entrepreneurial leaders. We're trying to train leaders of exceptional integrity who have the ability to confront the complex problems, to ask the right questions, and come up with workable solutions.
On the homepage of your website for your school, the first thing you see is ethical leadership, innovative thinking, a new Africa. That's the banner. Explain to me why these three ideals are the first thing a potential student will see if they're searching for information about your school on the webpage.
Ethical leadership has to do with integrity. It has to do with compassion. It has to do with empathy. And it is the first thing that any future leader or any citizen should be taught. Because we live in a world and we operate with others around us, and we ought to be taught how to improve the human condition, if you will. Innovative thinking has to do with the fact that much of what needs to be built in Africa is yet to be built. There are lots of problems that need to be solved, and we need to educate people who are innovators. And teaching people to be innovators has to do, I would say, primarily with courage, right? So the courage to imagine, the courage to act, the courage to persist in that action. And these are so incredibly important. And we feel, my team and I, that if we educate people and do these two things, develop ethical leaders and innovative thinkers, that we would have set the groundwork for a new Africa.
One of the things I found interesting in researching about you and your school is that you think Africa needs homegrown leaders to bring about change. Why is that?
I don't know of any other place in the world where changes come from outside. And I think that people who've been raised in Africa, who understand the culture and how things operate here, and who have a deeper appreciation for the problems, are actually in the best position to solve the problems here. And that they should be, you know, at the forefront of figuring this out. They might use help from outside Africa, but really it is up to them to solve the problems here. And just as it has happened elsewhere in the world, I think in Africa, it's going to take African talent to cause a renaissance here, to cause a transformation on this continent.
I'll admit that there are times when it seems like mission impossible. But we must believe that these kids are smart, that if we involve them in their education, if we have them discuss the real issues that they confront, that our whole society confronts, and if we give them skills that enable them to engage the real world, that magic will happen. Now, a month into this project, which just started classes, I come to the office and I have this email from one of our students. And it said, very simply, I am thinking now. And he signs off, thank you. It's such a simple statement, but I was moved almost to tears because I understood what was happening to this young man. And it is an awesome thing to be a part of empowering someone in this way. I am thinking now.
Over 90% of your graduates have chosen to stay in Africa. What have they done, or what choices have they made that lets you know that your school is making an impact?
Most of our students who stayed are working in the private sector. There are some that are working with nonprofits and the government. We see that they very quickly get promoted to middle management and leadership positions wherever they are. It's a wide spectrum of activities that they're engaged in, and some of them have started businesses of their own. The thing that leads me to believe that we are accomplishing our mission is that we have alumni who come back to campus and talk with students here, and they tell us about the challenges they've had with corruption and how they've stood their ground, how they've acted in the ethical way and thrived, not in spite of it, but actually because of it. That by setting a different example, they get noticed and they actually help their companies prosper. And this gives me a lot of hope. We've seen students who've decided to work in not-for-profits, who've turned schools around, who are bringing Shesi's ethos of critical thinking to primary school and to junior high schools. And this is all very wonderful to see because it shows that what we're doing here doesn't just end at our gate, but it's actually rippling out into the society around us.
For many of them, it has been a life-altering experience. These young future leaders are beginning to understand the real business of leadership, the real privilege of leadership, which is, after all, to serve humanity. And it's just wonderful to see sort of these glimmers of the promise of what can happen if we train our kids right. I think that the current and future leaders of Africa have an incredible opportunity to drive a major renaissance on the continent. It's an incredible opportunity. There aren't very many more opportunities like this in the world. I believe that Africa has reached an inflection point with the march of democracy and free markets across the continent. We have reached a moment from which can emerge a great society within one generation. It will depend on inspired leadership, and it is my contention that the manner in which we train our leaders will make all the difference. Thank you. God bless.
Patrick Ewa, president of Ashesi University, thank you for joining us on the TED Radio Hour.
Thank you very much.
Patrick Ewa. You can find out more about Ashesi University and hear a report on Ashesi from NPR's Ophebia Quist-Arkton. Go to our website, ted.npr.org. This is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Allison Stewart. Andrew Mwenda is a Ugandan journalist who has spent his career fighting for free speech and economic empowerment throughout Africa. In 2007, Mwenda founded The Independent, a weekly magazine with a fierce tagline.
You buy the truth, we pay the price.
Andrew Mwenda joins us from Uganda's capital, Kampala. Andrew, welcome to the TED Radio Hour.
It's my great pleasure to be hosted by you, Alison.
Andrew, when you gave your TED talk, it was at a fortuitous time. It was when the G8 summit was taking place, and you used this as an opportunity to introduce your point. Let's listen to a little bit.
We are hosting this conference at a very opportune moment, because another conference is taking place in Berlin, the G8 summit. The G8 summit proposes that the solution to Africa's problems should be a massive increase in aid, something akin to the Marshall Plan. Unfortunately, I personally do not believe in the Marshall Plan. One, because the benefits of the Marshall Plan have been overstated. Its largest recipients were Germany and France, and it was only 2.5% of their GDP. An average African country receives foreign aid to the tune of 15% of its GDP, and that is an unprecedented transfer of financial resources from rich countries to poor countries.
So, Andrew, you point to the fact that 8 countries, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, UK, US, Canada, and Russia, were all going to discuss this African Action Plan to take what it described as the many challenges of Africa. And in some ways, that alone proves your point that the way people view Africa, some people, we should say, is as much a problem as anything else. Tell me a little more what disturbs you about the way countries in the G8 view Africa.
Well, Alison, my view is that most of the rich countries are attracted to Africa's poverty rather than its wealth. And in the process, they end up subsidizing our failures rather than rewarding our accomplishments. Although Africa has gross and grave problems, it also has a lot of opportunities and potential. And we would prefer to see people in the Western world, especially leaders of the G8, talking to their business community, talking to their traders about opportunities that are available for people to make investment in Africa. Instead, they talk about curing our malaria, teaching us how to use condoms, how to plant cassava, and things like that.
I want to get back to something in your TED talk where you discuss the sort of the dark side of compassion, which is pity.
Africa has immense opportunities that never navigate through the web of despair and helplessness that the Western media largely presents to its audience. But the effect of that presentation is it appeals to sympathy. It appeals to pity. It appeals to something called charity. And as a consequence, the Western view of Africa's economic dilemma is framed wrongly. The wrong framing is a product of thinking that Africa is a place of despair. What should we do with it? We should give food to the hungry. We should deliver medicines to those who are ill. We should send peacekeeping troops to serve those who are facing a civil war. And in the process, Africa has been stripped of self-initiative. I want to say that it is important to recognize that Africa has fundamental weaknesses, but equally it has opportunities and a lot of potential. We need to reframe the challenge that is facing Africa from a challenge of despair to a challenge of hope, and that is wealth creation. The challenge facing all those who are interested in Africa is not a challenge of reducing poverty. It should be a challenge of creating wealth. Sending somebody to school and giving them medicines, ladies and gentlemen, does not create wealth for them. Wealth is a function of income, and income comes from you finding a profitable trading opportunity or a well-paying job.
Andrew, the argument you make is one you hear sometimes in the United States, that social programs, aid, it creates a victim culture. And the other point of view is that aid sometimes gives people what they need to get on their feet so that they can take advantage of opportunities. Does either argument apply to aid to Africa?
Well, I could say that aid is not a homogeneous effort. It is heterogeneous. There is one form of aid specifically, and this is government-to-government aid, which I find much more destructive than people-to-people aid. You see, you also, as an individual, if you identified a young child in Africa who has great potential to go to Harvard University and become the best neurosurgeon in the world, and you provide that child with a scholarship to study, certainly that is a very positive intervention. First, because you're intervening in the life of this poor child to promote innovation, to promote or to leverage this child's strength, which is great brain power that can produce a nuclear physicist or a great political scientist. But the criticism I have is with government-to-government aid. These are large transfers of taxpayers' money from the Western world to governments in Africa. The net effect of those transfers is to disarticulate the government from the population, because the government looks now for every fiscal shortage, it looks at the international donor community for resources. That makes it lose interest in the productivity of its own citizens. So the only way we can refocus governments in Africa to have a vested interest in the entrepreneurial abilities of their citizens is to make their fiscal survival depend on their own people for tax revenues.
So much of this is about the way you frame things. And a lot of it comes from ignorance. You've heard people sometimes refer to Africa as a country. Talk to me about the right framing of Africa in the year 2012.
Well, if we look at Africa as a continent that has the most profitable stock exchange market in the world, if we look at Africa as the place with possibly the largest concentration of mineral and other natural resources in the world, if we look at Africa as the place with the youngest population of any continent in the world, there we will be able to see the kind of potential that Africa can bring onto the global trade and investment table. Look at the biggest problems facing African cities today. One is load shedding. There is insufficient electricity in most African cities to meet the demand. That is the best problem you can have. You know why, Alson? Because it creates an opportunity for people to invest in dams, solar and biomass energy to produce electricity for Africa's increasing and growing urban populations and even rural populations who now have the incomes to demand for electricity. In fact, every problem presents a great opportunity for investors not only to make money, but also to transform societies.
I found it fascinating in your talk. I listened back to it a couple of times. You described it as aid industry, charity industry.
Aid is the bad instrument. You know why? Because if the government's fiscal survival depends on it having to raise money from its own people, such a government is driven by self-interest to govern in a more enlightened fashion. The problem with the African continent and the problem with the aid industry is that it has distorted the structure of incentives facing governments in Africa.
Do you really see it as some sort of almost corporate entity?
Yes, because the aid industry is about $60 billion a year strong. That $60 billion has constituencies who profit from it. They may be private sector companies. They may be international aid experts that profit from it, so they have a selfish personal interest in its perpetuation. But also, the aid industry sits on a very high moral, even though lopsided plane, in the sense that when people are hungry and you propose that you need to give them food, when medicines are not available in hospitals and you propose that you should give money to governments in Africa to improve their healthcare delivery, on the face of it, it looks a great altruistic and humanitarian effort to make the right intervention in people's lives. The problem, of course, is aid has one important dysfunction, and that is that it lacks accountability systems both in the donor country and the recipient country. And that is why oftentimes it is diverted into the pockets of international aid bureaucrats and local politicians and civil servants.
Where does the issue of corruption in government play into this discussion?
Corruption in Africa still remains a challenge, although across the continent, the growth of democratic institutions, the stabilization of the political dispensation are all impacting heavily on corruption, and corruption may be reducing. But remember, Alison, corruption in and itself is not a threat to an investment, neither is there economic evidence that corruption per se is an impediment to economic development and transformation. So I don't think that corruption per se is the biggest problem in Africa. Perhaps the perception of corruption in Africa could be the biggest problem. The state has significantly shrunk. And with the shrinkage of the state, the opportunities for corruption are also shrinking. You see, previously, governments controlled the foreign exchange. The only way an investor could get foreign exchange was by going and bribing government officials so that he can be given a foreign exchange license. Today, anybody can establish a forex bureau. You can go to any bank and buy foreign exchange. So the opportunities for corruption have been curtailed. And therefore, corruption right now has remained a bad brand that Africa was associated with in the past, rather than a significantly consistent constraint to investment.
But I'm wondering about, at the end of your TED talk, you give that long list of where some of the aid money goes to the 70 cabinet ministers, the 114 presidential advisors.
We have 81 units of local government, a bureaucracy, a cabinet, a parliament, and so many jobs for the political hangers on. 333 members of parliament, 134 commissions, and semi-autonomous government bodies, all of which have directors and cars and...
Yes, and the point I was making there is that whenever you have resources flowing to the government in the context where the person giving the money and therefore able to hold the government to account is not a citizen of that country, then you tend to reinforce corruption. Just imagine, of all the aid that comes to Africa to finance a parliament that can only sit in a stadium, to finance very many units of local government, assuming that money was coming in form of private investment, as much as possible, avoid creating alliances between international politicians and local politicians through an industry called charity or aid. Create opportunities for African citizens who are enterprising in the market to be able to invest and trade with equally enterprising individuals from the Western world. Only then can you create opportunities of mutual benefit through innovation and private enterprise. When the alliance is between politicians and politicians, what you get is corruption.
I want to conclude our conversation sort of where we began, talking about media and perception. And you've described a situation where people in Africa are aware of the descriptions of their continent and their countries and the generalizations about their lives, and that it's actually reinforced the reality of some of these negative stereotypes. How do you see this played out? And how should we approach topics differently so that this is not an outcome?
I think that we need to begin a conversation. And I am happy that many individuals and institutions in the West, including organizations like BBC and CNN, have been going through a review. If you look at The Economist, in 2000, they had a cover with the map of Africa, and the headline was "The Hopeless Continent." Last year, the same Economist had a new cover with a map of Africa, and it was saying "Africa Rising." So that even the most skeptical newspaper in the world, The Economist, about Africa, right now is beginning to change its narrative on Africa. By me and you and so many other listeners out there, if we keep saying, look, yes, it is important for us to cover Africa's failures, cover them accurately, cover them truthfully in a fair and balanced way, but also do not only focus on Africa's failures. There are great things happening on this continent. Let us give them coverage. And I think that is beginning to happen. The positive story is beginning to come out. So all these efforts are an attempt to create an intellectual space through which we can articulate the view that so far the coverage of Africa, while truthful, has focused more on purveying prejudice rather than conveying information.
Andrew Mwenda, thanks for sharing your thoughts on the TED Radio Hour.
The pleasure is all mine, Alison, and thank you so much for hosting me.
Journalist Andrew Mwenda, founder of the news magazine The Independent. You can link to The Independent's website by going to ted.npr.org. Joining us once more is TED's Emeka Okafor. Emeka, when I spoke to Andrew Mwenda, he was so optimistic about the potential for investment in Africa. As someone, if you were thinking just completely within business confines, why would I invest somewhere where I'm not confident the government is not corrupt?
Well, firstly, we're talking about 54 countries.
Right, obviously, yes.
And the level of corruption varies as much as the number of countries. Mm-hmm. And if we were to use the metrics of corruption to talk about where we invest, I would like to ask where Americans currently invest that doesn't have some degree of corruption. I think it's more perception of how corrupt a society is than whether it presents enough opportunity. Even an African, a Nigerian, a Kenyan, they have to deal with these challenges as much as the next person. If they wanted to do business within their own countries, talk less of what an American investor may think. So there is a need for that to lessen for the Africans themselves, which I think is actually the more important conversation than it is for the investor in New York or Los Angeles. I think when it comes to the American investor, what a number of people believe will happen is by the time Americans see many parts of this continent as a place they should invest, others would have beaten them to it. Hmm. It's already happening. Be it the Chinese, be it the Indians, be it the Malaysians, or people from other African countries who look at their history. You know, because if a Chinese person or an Indian or someone from Brazil is in a place like Angola or Nigeria or Liberia, to some degree, they see themselves. They see what they have overcome and where they are now. And by the time things are as pristine, and it's not just about corruption, it's also about infrastructure, it's also about the perception of violence. By the time you get to the point where it is safe and comfortable, it's already over.
Let's project 5 years out, right? We've been talking so much about what has changed since the 2007 conference. Can you think about 2017, what you hope you'll see, what stories we hope we'll be telling, how the narrative will have shifted?
You know, when you look at much younger Africans in places like Lagos, Nairobi, Accra, they don't have this perception of not being able to do things. There is a very vibrant popular culture scene in music, in fashion, that is very, you know, it doesn't have any doubts about itself.
And people from other places on the globe don't have those doubts who are their
yes.
peers.
So, you know, you have young African musicians and artists and fashion designers circulating within Africa who, if you were to talk to them about this depiction, they would look at you askance and wonder, well, where are you? What planet are you from? One could argue maybe it's more evident with the diaspora than it may be within certain groups on the ground. But if we see these trends continue, there will be surprises, pleasant surprises. I think the extent to which we can continue to lend a helping hand, a supportive hand, and actually be involved ourselves with those who are on the ground is critical. So I would say 5 years from now, in areas of culture, innovation, manufacturing, we're not just going to see the emergence of trends that surprise us, but we might see much more bidirectional activity, where it's not just about what we can do with our money, it's what we're learning from them. And I think the world will be better for it if that happens.
Emeka Okafor, thank you for being with us on the TED Radio Hour. It was a pleasure talking with you.
And likewise, thanks for having me.
Our program is produced by Jeff Rogers, Sam Greenspan, and Megan Kane. Thanks also to NPR's Ophabia Quist-Arkton and Eric Newsom. Special thanks to our partners at TED, especially Emeka Okafor, the director of TED Global in Arusha, Tanzania. You can watch dozens of TED Talks about Africa and hundreds of others. Go to TED.com. I'm Allison Stewart. You've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.